Good morning. I hope you guys are having a great day. We're going to start the next section now, which is on the chemical reactions. And we've spent time talking about the elements, the letters. We then talked about compounds, which is taking the letters to make, if you will, words. And we're going to finish this segment now by seeing how you actually make compounds, which is kind of my equivalent of making a sentence in chemistry, which I know is strange. And really, this is this chapter is why chemists get paid, because someone doesn't usually just give you money for free. And so in this chapter, we'll see how chemists get paid, how they make things, how they predict how much will be made, how they know how much they'll need, stuff like that. And along the way, we'll see it. This is a reaction. On the left-hand side is iodine crystals. Iodine is a solid. And there is some zinc. And if you take those, this is powdered zinc, by the way, not the zinc we used last week in the empirical formula. But if you do that, a lot of energy is created. This purple gas kind of stuff is iodine that's been vaporized. It's relatively easy to make iodine into a gas. And the substance that remains is zinc 2 iodide, or zinc iodide. And we'll talk about how you could make this yourself if you wanted to, using the ideas behind the reactions. But when you hear a reaction thing and stuff, you have to realize that really all it is a type of a recipe. And, you know, I am not a good cook. But if I have to, I can go in and I can make things. I'll follow the recipe and stuff like that. I'll know how much flour to add and water or eggs or whatever and stuff like that. And usually my stuff comes out a little less exciting than this. But once in a while, I might have a fire if I didn't follow the procedure right and stuff like that. So, all of what we're doing, really, in this first part is just talking about the recipes of chemistry, like how you make things, all right? And you guys have done this already when you did the empirical formula lab. You took the copper chloride solution, you added some zinc to it, some copper metal was made, all right? Not quite as much fun as a lot of things you make in the kitchen, but still the same kind of thing. And it's really important to follow our sig figs. Having a decimal point here and there can make a big difference and stuff, so yeah. So anyway, this right here is a type of a bare bones recipe in chemistry. And we're going to talk about the different pieces that go into this recipe and stuff on this slide. And reactants and products are terms we'll use a lot. Reactants are things you put into the reaction, and products are the things you get out of the reaction. So if I'm hungry and I want to make muffins, say, I probably wouldn't eat flour and pure water or something like that. I would be more interested in the outcome, the thing you're going to get out of the recipe, which would be the muffin. This is not appetizing at all, probably nothing you even want to look at. But in this reaction, all right, we're putting aluminum and oxygen in to make aluminum oxide. But you'll see that there's some cool kind of symbols and stuff that we'll talk about. The first thing I want to do is talk about these big numbers right there. These numbers are called stoichiometric coefficients. That's their snob name, and you never have to memorize or spell it or anything like that. But it literally relates to the number of pieces that you need. For example, you need 4 aluminum atoms to make 2 of these aluminum oxides. You can see there's 2 times 2, there's 4 aluminum atoms over here. And if we put 4 aluminum atoms in, that's where they end up at. But we also need oxygen atoms, obviously. Oxygen is a diatomic, one of the have no fear of ice clear brew things. 3 times 2, 6 oxygens in, and those 6 oxygens go to the 2 aluminum oxides. You can see there's a 3 there. 3 times 2 is 6. So notice here that what we're doing is we're kind of being accountants, all right? We're putting in 4 aluminum atoms and 3 times 2, 6 oxygen atoms. And those 4 aluminum atoms and 6 oxygen atoms are present on the other side. It's really important that we use stoichiometric coefficients because we're not alchemists, all right? We are going to account for everything we put in and everything that comes back out. That's really the big deal of this section, all right? Everything that goes in has to be accounted for on the way back out. And you won't have mysterious mass appear or mysterious mass disappear. It's not quite as exciting, I know, but in this world, that's really important. Now, stoichiometric coefficients, the way I just described them, refer to the atoms that go in. So four aluminum atoms go in, and those four aluminum atoms come out in terms of aluminum oxide. But you probably have already figured out that that 4, 3, and 2, those stoichiometric coefficients, are also going to relate the moles that go in and the moles that come out. So if I put 4 moles of aluminum in, those 4 moles had better be accounted for on the product side. 2 times 2, 4 moles come out. And if I put 3 times 2, 6 moles of O2 in, I had better get 6 moles out here somehow. 2 times 3, definitely balanced. So the number one thing we're going to start talking about right away is this accountability. All right, what goes in, we have to know what it is, and we have to know then what comes out, and they should be the same. So again, everything to the left of this arrow is going to be a reactant, which is what you put into a reaction. And everything to the right of the arrow will be a product. So in this reaction, 4 aluminums, 4 moles of aluminum, if you will, plus 3 moles of O2 make 2 moles of aluminum oxide. Now, a thorough reaction will also include a thing in parentheses like this. This helps us to understand the states of matter. There's a big difference between something that reacts as a solid and something that reacts in, say, a solution or a gas. S, as you probably realized, is going to be a solid. So here we're dealing with aluminum that's a solid form. It's not like gaseous aluminum or something like that. Oxygen here, you can see, is a gas. That's its normal form. We're not using liquid oxygen or something like that. And the product that comes out is also a solid. So S stands for solid, G stands for gas. What do you think L stands for? Liquid, that's right. So if you're drinking water, that's probably at this temperature, liquid water, you put an L next to it. AQ is something we'll spend more time talking about in the next chapter. But what it means is you have a solution. You have something dissolved in water. AQ means aqueous. So for example, coffee, you should really put coffee AQ because water is the bulk thing that you're drinking. The caffeine and the coffee essence and stuff like that, those things would be all AQ. They're in the water. You could also have the raw coffee bean. I could place one of those on the table. That would be coffee parentheses S to represent it's a solid. Woo-hoo. And we'll see that there's sometimes a difference between when things react as a solution, AQ, or as a solid S. Any questions on this, guys?
Yeah, so do you always just get one product?
No, you can have multiple reactants and multiple products. You can also have just one reactant and one product. It kind of depends on the nature of what you're looking at and stuff. So just like there's different types of recipes, making pasta is different than muffins, all right? There's different types of chemical reactions too, and you can have multiple reactants and only one product, or multiple products and only one reactant. We'll talk about that a little bit coming up too. Other questions, yeah?
Just nomenclature-wise, say we have two products, how do we differentiate two separate products from like two products that have to stay together for like one formula as a finished product?
Can you give me an example of that, Blake?
Say we took the aluminum and the oxygen and we got, you know, one form of aluminum oxygen and another form of aluminum oxygen.
Oh, like an allotrope or something.
Yeah.
Okay, then sometimes in the little parentheses, you'll see like version 1, version 2, or something like that, right? That's rare, but it does happen and stuff. Yeah, Kenzie.
So just to clarify, what I think you're asking, if we ended up with multiple products on the other side, mm-hmm. we put an addition side in between those two?
That's right, exactly. And I will show examples of that coming up.
Plus that.
That's right. 99.99% of the time, all you see are solids, gases, aqueous, and liquids, but it is possible to see stuff like that too, absolutely. Jessica?
I still don't really understand being a liquid and aqueous.
Uh-huh. Cool. Would you rather drink liquid water or salt water? Salt water is aqueous. Salt, sodium chloride, a solid, has been placed in water and dissolved. They look the same. Barbara hands me them. She goes, here you go, Russell, have a drink. Oh, salt water. Ah, all right. They look the same, but they're quite different in their properties. All right. So salt water is salt, NaCl, which is normally table salt, a solid. It's been placed in water and stirred around. It then becomes NaClAq. So it's a solution of salt in the water. Water is a pure substance, so that's when you would use the L. You could also have pure gasoline, all right, or pure olive oil, or pure kerosene, or something.
Right, the formula for water.
In which one?
H2O.
Correct. You would write NaCl parentheses AQ, and the hip chemist will know then that that's sodium chloride in water, but it doesn't actually show up as water. Excellent question. Yeah, really cool. Yes. Yeah.
So what is H2O2?
H2O2 is hydrogen peroxide. Right on. That's a different compound. And if you have pure H2O2, and wear your safety glasses, that could be H2O2 liquid, all right? If you go to the Bimart, which is where I buy my hydrogen peroxide, okay, that would be actually H2O2 in water. I would write H2O2 aqueous and stuff. Yes. Love it. Other questions? Come on, more clicks. All right, darn it. Anyway, all right. So let's look at some. Okay, here's a little thing about my iClicker. My base is definitely dying. Tomorrow, I'm supposed to get a new base. But even me now here, I just lost connection to the base. So we're going to play with the iClicker today. It should be fine on Friday. There we go, now I can change. So we'll talk about that when the questions come up. Sorry about this, this is first time in all these years this happened. But anyway, here's another reaction. This takes phosphorus, P4, it reacts it with chlorine to make phosphorus trichloride. Now if you look at the states of these, phosphorus, P4, is a solid. It reacts with chlorine, a gas. That's what this little tube thing here is for. A lot of energy is released, but we end up making PCl3, which is a liquid. And again, those stoichiometric coefficients, which is a name you don't have to know, but those refer to the numbers outside. You need one of these phosphorus, which comes in fours. You don't need to worry about that, but it's P4. To make PCl3 then, we need to account for all the atoms that go in. So we'll end up with four PCl3s to make the phosphorus atoms balance. 4 times 3 means we need 12 chlorines. Chlorine, a diatomic, one of the have no fear, of ice clear blues comes in twos. 6 chlorines will balance the number of atoms over here. So we would write P4 as a solid plus 6Cl2 as a gas, going to PCl3 as a liquid. Now, sometimes chemists honestly get lazy, and I will fall in this camp sometimes, where you don't include the states of matter, and that's okay. But because I'm trying to look professional to you guys, because I had this nice slide made up, I mean, because this is a great learning moment, phosphorus is a solid, this is a gas, and you can look at those two on the periodic table. So phosphorus, P, there is a black element, that means it's a solid. Chlorine is a red element, that means it's a gas. But it would be difficult for any of us, myself included, to know the state of PCl3 unless we looked it up. So if you have information on the state, it's awesome to include it, but if you don't have it, that's okay too. It's more important to know what the reactants are and what the products are that come out of it. Here's another example with iron. Iron is not a diatomic, it's not have no fear of ice clear brew, so we write that as just Fe. But again, chlorine is a diatomic, we'll write that as Cl2. And what we're making here is an iron 3 chloride, FeCl3. So these stoichiometric coefficients, those big numbers in front then, will help us to make sure that the atoms that go in equal the atoms that go out. Now, you can sometimes see evidence that something has happened, evidence that a chemical reaction has happened. Definitely heat change is one. A lot of times things will feel warm. In the empirical formula lab, some of you felt the beaker. It definitely had a lot of warmth coming out. You might see a solid form, which I call a precipitate. So like in the empirical formula lab again, you saw the red solid appear, which is kind of cool. But sometimes you also might see gases happening. You might see colors changing and stuff, as we saw. You might also see nothing at all. So you just have to be as observant as possible, use what you know about it to figure out what's going on. So aluminum plus oxygen making aluminum oxide, this is actually what happens. A lot of energy is given up, so there's no question that a reaction has occurred. But what I want to focus on right now is this relationship that chemists have built up between what's happening on the atomic level and what's happening on the macroscopic level. Now, if we could zip down to the level of atoms, this reaction right here says that four aluminum atoms plus three oxygen molecules, three O2s, makes two molecules of aluminum oxide. So in theory, you could go down to the level of these atoms and you'd see all these things kind of coming together. But it's really hard, of course, in our world to go down to that level. The technology just isn't quite there yet most of the time. But what we can do, even here at Mount Hood, woohoo, is we can measure the moles. The way that this has been built up, it's really cool. So instead of thinking on it in atoms and molecules going to molecules, you can also think about it in terms of the moles. Four moles of aluminum react with three moles of O2 to create two moles of aluminum oxide. And we can measure all these things. So aluminum, as we've seen on the periodic table, about 27 grams per mole. So if you measure out 27 grams and multiply it by four, that would be the grams inherent to four moles of aluminum. And if you added the corresponding amount of oxygen, you would end up making two moles of aluminum oxide. So this kind of back and forth thing is really powerful as a chemist. You can think about what's happening on the atomic level, and you can also, though, measure it on our world, which is more meaningful.
Mercury 2 oxide breaks down or decomposes readily when heated. If we were to weigh the compound before heating and compare its mass to that of the mercury remaining after the reaction, it would seem that decomposition causes a change in the system's mass. The product mercury would weigh less than the reactant. In reality, the decomposition liberates the reactant's oxygen atoms as gaseous dioxygen O2. All matter present before the reaction still exists after it. The reaction obeys the law of conservation of matter.
So in the old days, they would do a reaction like this, which was a mercury oxide, all right? And they'd heat the mercury oxide up, and all the mass after heating was less than the mass before. And they talked about how, oh, there's this ether stuff that goes all over the world and blah, blah, blah. And it's kind of interesting to read about, honestly, but it's totally false. Because what's happening, as we know now, after years of study, is that that mercury oxide is breaking up. And the mercury remains, the quicksilver, which is why they wanted to probably do this reaction in the first place, and oxygen gas is being liberated. So the difference, again, between chemistry and alchemy is that in chemistry and stuff, we try and figure out what's happening, where the mass is going, where it came from, stuff like that. And that's just a little bit different from the way they did it in the old ways. So in chemistry, all right, the mass that goes in always equals the mass that comes out. All right, that's a fundamental part of this science, and there's no exceptions to that. And this is kept up in what's called the law of conservation of matter. And sometimes, because that's too many syllables, I think, it sometimes is called law of mass action. And it just means what goes in must come back out. Now, in Chem 222, at the end of the term, I'm going to show you a time when this actually does break down. I'm going to show you that right now. We can't talk about it right now. I'll get on off target. I'll get more off target than I am normally. But 99% of the time, right, just like there's only solid, liquid, gases, and aqueous, and not different allotropes, 99% of the time, the mass that goes in has to equal the mass that comes out. It will be all the time in 10 to 21, and the rest of the classes, it will be 99% plus of the time. So law of mass action, law of conservation of matter, just means we're going to be chemical accountants. We're going to make sure that what goes in is accounted for on the way back out. No mystery gases, no like shoving some things under the rug. Not that I do that at home. Yeah, that's right. We're going to just be really good, astute scientists, observers of the world. Lavoisier was the scientist that came up with this idea. And Lavoisier was a real famous chemist. Look at the date, 1788. So very, very early, a long time ago and stuff. And he came up with this idea and proposed then that to count for the mass that comes in and the mass that comes out, you have to have these balanced equations. So you have to have the same types of atoms going in as they come back out. Lavoisier is a really interesting person to read about. He got on the wrong side, though, of the French Revolution, and the guillotine took our famous scientists from us. But alas, politics and science keep them separate most of the time. Anyway. The which one? That's right. Yeah, it took its head, man. So, poor. Anyway, don't get me started on politics. Anyway, questions on Lavoisier and mass action. Okay. These are just fun.
When pieces of aluminum foil are placed in a beaker containing bromine, a violent reaction occurs. The elements react to produce aluminum bromide, which consists of two aluminum atoms for every six bromine atoms. It is visible as a white powder deposited on the beaker.
So aluminum, which is the same stuff made of aluminum cans and stuff like that, can react with liquid bromine. Here liquid is L-I-Q, which is fine. Sometimes you'll see a cursive L there. These are always to represent liquid. But anyway, it makes a compound called aluminum bromide. Now aluminum bromide normally is one aluminum and three bromines. Aluminum is one of the twisted metals in group 3A. And we'll talk more about this twisted metal thing that I call them. But if you look carefully at these drawings, there's two funny arrows right there. There's an arrow pointing that way from this bromine to that aluminum, and there's an arrow pointing this way from this bromine to that aluminum. There's a reason why the twisted metals name popped in. All you need to worry about for this reaction is that these two aluminum bromides are coming together. They call this a dimer sometimes, which means two pieces coming together. So if we assume for this reaction that this is the product, aluminum is not a diatomic. It's not a have no fear of ice clear bruise. So we write it aluminum by itself. But bromine is a diatomic. Have no fear of ice clear brew. The brew is the bromine. So we're writing bromine as two, like we do all the diatomics. Everything else just as one. So if you look here long enough, you'll see that this weird product has two aluminums. So we're going to need two aluminum atoms to make one aluminum bromide. And because bromine appears in pairs, each one of these is like one Br2, you can see that there are six bromine atoms in the product, so we'll need three Br2s to make this happen. So the stoichiometric coefficients, or the numbers that go in front, and that's fine to call them that, we would have two in front of the aluminum, one, two, a three in front of the bromine, one, two, three Br2s, and we wouldn't put a one right there, we would just call this Al2Br6. So this is like a graphical representation of what the equations are trying to tell you, all right? Two aluminum atoms, three bromine molecules, three Br2s, makes one Al2Br6. Yeah?
And why isn't it two AlBr3?
Cool. It has to do with this thing's twisted nature. The electrons and the bromine are being pushed into aluminum ions. And I promise in Chem 222 to talk more about this. But for right now, just take it as a leap of faith that this is what forms, man. It has to do with weird group three. Bromine, sorry, thanks for playing. Boron, aluminum, and gallium all do this a lot, actually.
Yeah.
So would Al2Br6 be the empirical formula?
In this case, it's the empirical and the molecular formula, right on. And again, the empirical formula would be just AlBr3. The molecule itself is Al2Br6, but the empirical smallest whole number would still be AlBr3. Good. Please don't get real hung up on the chemistry here. There's some other things going on that I haven't shared with you yet. Sorry, fascist chemist. But just if you assume that this is the product, then two ALs and three BR2s would make one of these AL2BR6s. Good.
Other question?
In the combustion of propane, a single propane molecule reacts with five molecules of O2 to produce three molecules of carbon dioxide and four molecules of water.
Propane is what's used in some barbecue kind of systems. So if you've grilled up your garden burgers, then maybe you've used propane. And the flame that comes from propane is a reaction of the propane with oxygen to make CO2, which is what this thing is right there, and also some water. So let's say you were really interested to know the stoichiometric relationships between these. No problem. This thing right here, which is not a compound I expect you to know right now, is called propane. It's an example of a simple type of organic chemical. It's C3H8. And it's going to react with oxygen in the air. Oxygen is one of the have no fear of ice clear brews, so we do put a 2 next to it. And the only products here are CO2 and water. So what we want to do, if you want to balance this equation, is again, you just need to make sure that all of the atoms that go in equal all of the atoms that go out. Now, in this next step, we can play with the big numbers in front, the stoichiometric coefficients, as much as we want. But you don't want to turn H2O into H2O2. So like Meg just asked about a while ago, H2O2 is a lot different than H2O. So you don't want to change the inner relationships between like hydrogen and oxygen or carbon and oxygen, but you can play with these big numbers as much as you want. So let's say that we have C3H8, it reacts with O2, it makes CO2 and water. What we want to do is figure out a balanced reaction that represents the atoms that are going in and the atoms that are coming out. If you're unclear if a reaction is balanced or not, one thing that can help you in this section is to literally write like a line right through the arrow, all right? And on the line, put all of the atoms in the reaction. So this one only has carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. And if your reaction is balanced, then the CH and O on the left will equal the CH and O on the right. So as an example of this, C3H8 means 3 carbons, 8 hydrogens, and right now we have 2 oxygens. On the right-hand side, I have 1 carbon, I have 2 oxygens from CO2, hydrogen is 2 here, and I have 1 right there. Are any of these numbers the same on the left and the right hand side? No, they're all totally messed up, right? We have 3 right now on the left and only 1 on the right, and 8 on the left and 2, etc., etc. So this is not a balanced reaction. If this reaction is balanced, then the atoms of carbon on the left should equal the atoms of carbon on the right, stuff like that. So at this point, you kind of have to start playing with the reaction, playing with those stoichiometric coefficients. And again, you don't want to write C3 right there, O2, all right? That That's for Volta. Don't do that. Yeah, CO2 is CO2, and you're not going to make it C3O2 no matter how hard you try or you wave your magic wand. Trust me, I've tried. But what you can do, again, is play with the big numbers, the stoichiometric coefficients. Now, if you have an element by itself, try to balance that one last. So on this one, what I would recommend is, obviously we have too much carbon on the left. Let's put a big 3 right there, all right? Because at the very least then, that will make the carbons balance. 3 C's on the left and 3 C's on the right. Absolutely. I've totally changed the number of oxygens now. So I'm going to cut out this 2, which is where it came from before, and put a 6 right there. So my carbons at least are good, but obviously my oxygens are far from it. Water comes in pairs of 2 hydrogens at a time, and I have 8 hydrogens total on the left. What would be a good number to start with right here?
4.
Well done. If you put a 4 right there in front of water, 4 times 2, this turns into an 8. And now my hydrogens are balanced as well. But as you can see, yeah, I hear you guys talking, which is good. Now I've got extra oxygen on top of it. I now have 4 oxygen from water and 6 oxygens from CO2. And notice how I wrote it 6 plus 4. That's a good way for me to remember that the first one, for example, is from CO2 and the second one is from water. Now, this is balanced, carbon 3 and 3. Hydrogen's balanced, 8 and 8, good to go. But oxygen, as you can see, now I have 10 on the right, 6 plus 4, and only 2 on the left. So what can I put right there to make my hydrogen, oxygen?
5.
5, well done. I see a lot of you thinking, well done. 5 times 2 makes this 10, double check. 3, 3, check. 8, 8, check. 10 equals 6 plus 4, check. Balanced reaction. Woohoo, I did it right. Questions on this very juvenile example I've just went through is actually really helpful. And I'll be honest, I still use it myself once in a while because, like, are you sure? Is it really balanced and stuff? All right. Now, let's say that Barbara looks at this reaction and goes, is this really balanced? Gosh, check yourself, man. Go back to the balanced reaction and make sure that these things balance. So 3 carbons and 8 hydrogens and 5 times 2, 10 oxygens. On the right-hand side, I have 3 carbons, 6 oxygens from CO2, 8 hydrogens, 4 right there. And sure enough, you can see that they do balance. So you can always go back and check yourself, and it's a powerful tool in this. Any questions? Let's do another one. This one is a boron compound, all right? Boron is another one that you can take. You react it with some oxygen, B4H10. It reacts with O2, and it makes boric oxide, which is not a compound you need to know, but that's what it is, and water, all right? So again, a similar kind of problem. And we should check and see if it's balanced. And it probably doesn't take a lot to see that it's not. But again, how you set it up. B, H, and O are the 3 types of atoms on both sides. So if you do this way, you can have this kind of a system. 4 borons there, 10 hydrogens there, and 2 oxygens. Those are the atoms we have on the reactant side right now. This side has 2 borons, 3 oxygens, 2 hydrogens, and 1 oxygen. So as you can probably see here, this reaction is not balanced. The borons on the left are not equal to the borons on the right. Same for hydrogen, same for oxygen. So to balance this one, try to leave the oxygen alone. Do that the last one because it's an element by itself. We can play with everything else up here and hopefully have everything else balanced except for the O2s. So what I would do on this kind of problem is I would put a 2 right here by the B2O3. That changes this 2 to 4, and that changes this 3 to 6. What kind of number would you initially think might go in front of water? 5, well done. Hydrogens are 10 here, they come in 2s. Let's put a 5 right there. That changes the hydrogens to 10, and then I have 5 oxygens. So, if you look now, 6 plus 5, 11 oxygens on the right. And oxygen, that crazy diatomic, only comes in pairs of 2. So, at this point, what we'd like to do is write 11 halves O2. Because we need 11 atoms of oxygen on the right, and oxygen only comes in 2s. So 11 halves times the 2 oxygen, that would be the way we'd get to like 11 oxygen atoms. So this is arguably balanced, but in this section, we don't want to use fractions, all right? Because you can't have like a half of an O2 molecule. So if you get to this point, how can we get rid of the fraction? Multiply by 2. Well done. So what we're going to do now to get rid of this fraction, multiply by 2. 11 halves times 2 is 11. 2 times 2 is 4. 5 times 2, 10. Whoa, Russell, what the heck did you just do, man? Okay, wow, I did a lot of magic. I didn't keep up with my balancing. I'm gonna propose this is balanced, but let's make sure it's balanced. So this is a good time to go back and let's see if our work actually makes sense or not. So 2 times 4 here would be 8 borons. 2 times 10, 20 hydrogens. 11 times 2, 22 oxygens. On the product side, I'm hoping to get these same numbers here. So 4 times 2, 8 borons. 4 times 3, 12 oxygens. Oh, not enough oxygens. But wait, oxygen's over here. All right, sound effect's not necessary, sorry. 10 times 2, 20 hydrogens. If you don't love what you do, you shouldn't do it. Plus 10 oxygens, all right? So 8, 20, boom, everything's balanced. If you put this one through, bam. Any questions on that? All right. Usually, people do pretty well balancing reactions, but that's the big thing to start this chapter off, all right? Practicing makes perfect. You can use my accounting method to make sure that the left and the right-hand side, but after a while, a lot of times you won't need this, all right? You'll get really good at it. But if you are new to it, just practice and stuff, get it together and see what's going on. Questions? Okay. Let's do an iClicker question. Now, before we even start, I need to say that the base unit here is definitely dying. And tomorrow, I'm supposed to be getting a brand new base unit. I don't care if you get the right answer or not. Keep pushing buttons. Earlier, Blake was trying and stuff to do it, and it's like, at first, A would work, but B would. Try to participate. I see 3 of you are doing it. But anyway, back to the chemistry. We have here a reaction between phosphorus and chlorine to produce phosphorus trichloride. And if you look on this little picture right here, phosphorus is P4. Don't worry about that. Chlorine, one of the diatomics, is Cl2. And phosphorus trichloride is PCl3. So of these things, let's see which one of these is right. All right. The reaction involves 1 phosphorus atom and 6 chlorine atoms to create 1 PCl3. Are the atoms that go in there equal to the atoms that go out? No, that's right. If you're only making 1 PCl3, you would only have 3 Cl atoms. So 1 P and 6 Cls would certainly not make PCl3. That one is incorrect. But if you look down here at the second one, and you look at these pictures, P4 is actually this weird tetramer, is what they call it. Don't worry about that. It's a 4 phosphorus group that we have to add. And if you're going to make PCl3, you're going to end up needing 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 chlorine atoms, or 6 Cl2 molecules, to make the 4 PCl3s. So if you look at this one, you do need 4 phosphorus atoms and 12 chlorine atoms to produce 4 PCl3 molecules. So B is the correct answer. The last one is almost the same as the first one. You have 6 Cl's and 1 phosphorus to make 4 PCl3. That's totally messed up. Anyway, questions on that? So some hints on balancing reactions, all right? You want to balance those atoms which occur on only one compound on each side, and then balance the remaining ends. So for example, in this last one, it's a good idea to try and do the oxygen, which was by itself last. Oxygen appears in a couple other things, and boron appears with oxygen, but oxygen again is all by itself. So try and do the elements that are by itself at the very end. If you accidentally get 4, 22, 8, and 20, or all those numbers times 2, you will have a balanced reaction. But in chemistry, we always want to reduce down to the smallest whole number. So check yourself to make sure that the integers are the smallest whole numbers and also don't have fractions. And definitely, if you're uncertain if a reaction is balanced or not, check it, all right? So this last one, I was kind of whipping and whamming. We should definitely make sure that I'm whipping and whamming correctly. So we balance the B, H, and O at the end just to make sure that we're good to go. Finally, the charges of ions will also balance. That's something for future lectures. I'm just putting it in here. I'll show you examples of that. I'm more interested that you know the first ones than the last ones. So once you have a balanced reaction, there's actually some pretty cool things you can do with it. You can actually figure out how much product you're going to make. You're going to be able to calculate how much reactant you need. And this is, as I said to some people before lecture started, this is really where chemists begin to make their money, because they need to know like how many pounds of stuff you'll make or how many kilograms of reactant you're going to need. So stoichiometry is the study of quantity, all right? Like how much goes in and how much goes out. And that's not a name you have to know, but that's what stoichiometry means. A stoichiometric coefficient, again, are these big numbers that go in front of the reactants and products. And they help the scientists then to know amounts going in, amounts going out. And all of stoichiometry, again, rests on the idea that we know what goes in and we know what comes out. And we can figure out that if we don't know through gram amounts and stuff like that. If you have a reaction where 4 aluminums and 3 oxygens make 2 aluminum oxides, those really are like conversion factors. So reactants to products, you can write a bunch of different conversion factors. So for example, let's say that we wanted to know how much oxygen we'd need to react with 2 moles of aluminum. No problem. 4 moles of aluminum require 3 moles of oxygen. If you wanted to know how much aluminum oxide you would make from 17 moles of oxygen, no problem. 3 moles of oxygen create 2 moles of aluminum oxide. Let's say that we figure out that we created 54 moles of aluminum oxide. How much aluminum did it come from? No problem. 2 moles of aluminum oxide stem from 4 moles of aluminum. So up here, I have all the relationships that you can get from one chemical reaction. All right? Here's 4 moles of aluminum for every 3 moles of oxygen, or 3 moles of oxygen for every 4 moles of aluminum. Those would relate a reactant to a reactant. So if you wanted to know how much oxygen you need for the amount of aluminum you have, no problem. These sets over here relate a reactant to a product. So maybe you have so much reactant and you want to know how much product comes out. That's when you would use one of those things on the right-hand side. So just like we've seen this whole term so far, density, we've seen it in terms of molar mass, we've seen it in Avogadro's number, all these kind of $4 for $1, all these kind of things, these are nothing more than other kinds of conversion factors. You convert a mole of reactant to a mole of product, or a mole of product to a mole of reactant, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of power in these relationships, and this is where stoichiometry becomes really important. Let's see an example of how this works out. This is an example of a reaction called the Haber-Fish reaction. You don't need to worry about that. Nitrogen and hydrogen are combining in this reaction to make ammonia. Now, nitrogen and hydrogen are both diatomics, N2 and H2, and NH3 is ammonium. So if we figure out that we have 10 moles of hydrogen to react, we apparently have more nitrogen than we know what to do with, and we want to figure out the amount of ammonia we're going to produce, we need a relationship between the amount of hydrogen we start with and the amount of ammonia that we end with. So imagine we're starting here with 10 moles of H2, and we want to turn moles of H2 into moles of ammonia. We're going to want to put H2 on the bottom, and we're going to want to put NH3 ammonia on the top. Because if you think about it that way, you have 10 moles H2 times division, 2 moles NH3 over 3 moles H2, the moles of H2 will cancel. So let me show you what that looks like maybe better. 10 moles of H2 times 3 moles H2, 2 moles NH3. Where did I get this 2 over 3 ratio? Well done, Kenzie, well done. The product NH3 has a 2 in front of it. The reactant H2 has a 3 in front of it. That's where I got these two values right there. So the balanced equation will tell you the relationship between, in this case, a reactant H2 and a product NH3. Now, let's say that instead of 10 moles of H2, we have 5 moles of N2. And I want to figure out how much NH3 I'm going to make. I need to cancel the N2. I'm going to put it on the bottom. You know, chemists are obsessed with moles, so let's just fill the moles in right now. What numbers do I want to use here for nitrogen to ammonia? That's right. There's a 2 in front of the ammonia, so I'm going to put a 2 right there. Nitrogen has an invisible 1, so you could leave that right there. I would use a 2 over 1 ratio for converting nitrogen to ammonia. And this is the power of this kind of stuff. In the first case, we had excess nitrogen. In the second case, we had excess hydrogen. You can use a different relationship to get to the moles of product. Questions? So here's an example, a very practical example of how this stuff works. Ammonium nitrate is a powerful fertilizer, and it's used a lot in the country for crops and stuff like that. It's also a powerful explosive. Oklahoma City's explosion was caused, by this kind of stuff. So you have to be very careful. A lot of these chemicals will have a good side of the force and the bad side of the force, all right? And depending on which one you use, of course, I would encourage you, the good side, but no politics. Anyway, prop that back on. We're not worried about politics or anything like that. We're trying to figure out how much dinitrogen monoxide and water will be formed from this much ammonium nitrate, all right? 454 grams is actually a pound. You don't need to worry about it, but if you did, you'd have a pound of ammonium nitrate, and you want to figure out here how much of these things will form. We're going to be after what's called the theoretical yield of products. Now, to even start a reaction like this, what's the first thing you need? Yep, you need a chemical, balanced chemical reaction. And the reactant will be NH4NO3, and the products will be N2O and water. So before you start anything like this, You've got to know what's happening on the molecular level. So if you balance this one out, ammonium nitrate has two nitrogens, and they both go to the N2O. The three oxygens that are distributed to N2O and two waters, and it's two waters because there's a four hydrogens right there. So NH4NO3 breaks down into N2O and two waters.
Questions on that?
Now, if you have 454 grams of ammonium nitrate and you want to use this balance reaction, you've got to turn things into moles. So the first thing here I've done, you can see, is I took 454, I divided it by this 80.04 number to get 5.68 moles. How did I find this 80.04 number?
Molar mass.
Molar mass, good. Meg's pointing, yes, she knows the answer. A lot of you are pointing, yes, you've been listening, thank you. Anyway, yeah, add up two nitrogens, four hydrogens, and three oxygens. That will give you 80.04 grams. That represents then the moles of ammonium nitrate that we have here. Okay, I'm out of time. We will do more of this on Friday. Have a good day, guys. I'll see you soon.